I think that there is a massive opportunity for leaders within health to really open their minds about how we can do things differently.
Welcome to the Flippin' Health Podcast, where we turn medicine on its head, flip it upside down, shake it all about, and see what comes out. We're going to challenge convention and change medicine for the better.
Hello, I'm Grant Schofield.
And I'm George Henderson.
Welcome to the
Flippin' Health Podcast.
Grant Schofield here with Carlo Bellini. Can you tell us who you are and what you're about?
Absolutely. So my name's Carlo. I'm 36. I'm an Australian. I'm a medical doctor. I'm from Perth originally. I grew up there to a migrant family from Italy and Croatia and did the whole migrant small business owner life with both my parents being pharmacists. And that was really where I think from a very young age, working in the pharmacy every day, meeting people, getting really used to thinking about healthcare and the way that I wanted to impact the world. So from an early age, I really wanted to be a doctor. And I studied medicine at the University of Western Australia, worked as a doctor for a few years, mostly in cardiology. And I was always, throughout my medical school, and actually in advance of medical school, I was always interested in business and leadership as well. So I actually asked the University of Western Australia, could I do a combined medical and commerce degree?
They don't get asked that.
It was the first time they'd ever been asked that. And and I think they just were perplexed by why would anyone that wanted to become a doctor also wanted to understand something about business? So the answer was no, you can't do it. And I was always involved in medical student leadership and junior doctor leadership. And working in the clinical system, I got frustrated very much around we were doing things the way we always did them. There were no questions about doing things differently or how can we improve it. And I was at a fork in the road of choosing whether to specialize, and cardiology was the field I was mostly working in, or really go and explore outside and see how I could have an impact on the healthcare system from a much broader perspective.
So what is it about medical training that takes... You know, you have to be pretty smart, right, to get into medical school. But they're not taking the middle of the class people like Grant Schofield. They're taking the cream of the crop. So, how does that? Why are we stuck in a system that doesn't look outward and change rapidly, given the intelligence of the group we're dealing with?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think there's a few reasons for it. So, one is, as you say, take very, very smart people and then put them into a course and a role that is highly hierarchical, very reliant on rote learning, with very little room for creativity, exploration, and risk.
But there's some reasons for that, right? There's some real reasons for that.
Absolutely. So bureaucracies largely exist because we de-risk actions and tasks. But what happens in that system is you can often tend towards mediocrity, where you're protecting the catastrophic failures, but you're also killing people experimenting and trying things new. And I think in medicine, that's very much taught in such a way, and then you clinically practice in such a way, and you fit into set training programs where they're very highly structured for reasons, like you say, there's valid reasons for it, but it's really, really difficult to have both slices of the pie, to have that creativity, that exploration, that entrepreneurship, that risk in a system and a profession where risk is largely frowned upon and ostracized and we don't tolerate failure.
Right, but there are failures.
Yeah. There indeed are, and I think the healthcare world has moved more transparently, particularly in recent years, towards that. But in many ways, there's an opaqueness or a failure there. Let's say, for example, Boeing had the Air Max jet that crashed twice recently. That makes global news, and a whole fleet of planes, new planes, grounded globally. In healthcare, in terms of suboptimal care for whatever reason, whether that is systems, individuals, negligence or the like, it's really difficult to quantify that. Yep. And if we measure the number of people that there were adverse outcomes, they'd be really quite significant. But things keep ticking along because they need to in many ways.
Right. But an acute bad outcome in medicine looks much worse than lots of chronic bad outcomes.
Absolutely.
So, and that's an issue. Okay, so you were working in medicine. So where are we up to now? How old are you? What part of your life are you in? And,
yeah.
And
so what happened? So I was in my I was about 26 at that time, and I was thinking that I really want to go and upskill in leadership and business, because I saw a real absence of senior people in healthcare that had those skills as well, that were the clinicians that had really coupled them. A lot of those people had either not enjoyed working with patients, or they'd got into management through default, or they had been high up in their field and they were rewarded to manage, but didn't really have the skills.
Yeah. And so where do you head?
So I went to, I wanted to do a Master of Business Administration, an MBA, and I wanted to do it from a prestigious international university. So I went to Oxford and I did my MBA at Oxford, which was just a wonderful time. And that was great because I was one of the very, very few doctors in the course.
Right.
So I was immersed in this world of people from entrepreneurship, business, banking, consulting, and the broader university. So it was really like connecting all these different ideas together at one of the most amazing places to learn in the world.
Yeah, so loving it.
Loving it.
Yeah.
Loving it. And then after there, I really had no set plan and fixed address. And I ended up getting an offer for a job at a consulting firm, Boston Consulting Group, which is one of the top strategy consulting firms in the world. And I thought, why not? I'll try it. And in the interim, I had a really significant experience where I went to Silicon Valley in the US, really like the tech center of the world. And I was at a NASA and Google-sponsored program called Singularity University. It was a three-month immersive program, in some ways a bit sort of like a crash course in tech and the future. And the idea was if you bring people together from all different disciplines and they are big shots, smart people, curious people in all these different fields, can you solve some really big problems in the world by having different perspectives and connecting dots in different ways?
Right, and that's another level. People don't know Singularity University and its founders and its very future thinking around what the world would look like is really invigorating, isn't it?
Yeah, the idea is essentially that we're on a trajectory of exponential growth, and we've seen that very much in computers, where the price performance of computers has grown exponentially. And we're now starting to see that in fields outside of computing. For example, the most obvious example in healthcare is in DNA and mapping the human genome, where when it was first done, it was billions of dollars, and now you can get it done for thousands or less than thousands very easily.
So just depending on which direction you're going, you're seeing halvings in price and doublings in performance.
Correct.
And to start with, if you're watching that actually seems really slow.
Yeah.
So 3D printing might be an example at the moment. It's promised a lot for a lot of years, and it's definitely improved. Or solar panel efficiency.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden.
Absolutely. All of a sudden, then that it's that growing. It's like the bacteria in the Petri dish that you can't see it at the start, where it's N equals one. And then as it's doubling, suddenly the dish is full.
Yeah, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And then those are hardly noticeable and even detectable. And all of a sudden, 32 steps out from that. 32 divisions out, you're up to a billion, are we? Something like that?
I can't remember the exact maths, Grant, but it sounds about right. It might even be less.
Yeah.
It might even be less. But the thing that is interesting with that, I think we're seeing that, this was back in 2011. So we were talking about Bitcoin then when it was less than $2.
Yeah.
And it went up, it's been over $20,000, and now everyone's on crypto on the right. So it was at the very early stages of the tech growth.
Yeah.
And what was interesting, when I came back to Australia and talked to people in Australia about that, there was a real cognitive disconnect. People were just very, no, this isn't going to happen, the like. And now that we see companies like Uber and Netflix, where they're affecting people's personal lives, Amazon, and like where people can touch it and feel it and taste it, that they really now, we might not be able to see the future, but we can very much appreciate what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting, particularly in healthcare, with artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and you've done, let's talk about those moves, because then you do move into artificial intelligence.
So I worked for, I spent this time over there in the US, in Silicon Valley. It opened my eyes. It was something that once you see it, you can't unsee it. and now you're connecting dots in different ways.
Yeah.
And you can see opportunity and you can see problem in a different light perspective. So I worked in the consulting. I'm from Perth originally for some family reasons, and I wanted to head back to Perth, and I got an opportunity to be the chief medical officer of Chevron Australia, the energy company, and that was really interesting because I was 29, got the opportunity to be a pretty senior role in a massive company with 25,000 workforce,
wow.
And it was build the medical infrastructure and the wellness program for this business.
Yeah. And there were people that weren't doing that well because they were flying them out and in and out. It was
actually very interesting because the way we had a very large population. Our largest site was 8,500 people.
Yep.
And it's in the remote part of Western Australia on an island. So there's no, you can't drive to a hospital. We had to provide all of our own healthcare infrastructure on that island. And what was interesting is it's in many ways, it was both acute medicine, general practice, preventative health, all of these areas combined together in this little microcosm of the world.
Quite interesting to learn about everything in one space.
It was super interesting to learn about that. And then you start looking at preventative health and wellness and what can we do in those areas. And it was fascinating because I used to go visit the site, and the mess or the kitchen area was next to the gym and the outdoor basketball courts.
Yep.
And it was fascinating because you'd go there, you'd have dinner, you'd see a group, a cohort of people who are just training and working out super hard in the gym, and another cohort who are overweight, smoking, drinking. Next door to the gym.
Yeah, right.
And it really made me think, you know, like different people are driven by really different reasons. Mm-hmm. And even in this group, you've got people that they're going to be going to the gym and eating healthy and looking after themselves.
Yeah.
And this other group that, no matter what,
all the facilities there and everything.
Everything, trainers, facilities, a lot of investment. They just like, I just want to drink my beer and I just want to smoke. and it was absolutely an interesting time, an interesting exercise to think, because you know I do believe that healthcare in many ways prioritize science is incredibly important. Absolutely. Yeah. Science shows the right way and different what we should be doing, but there is a real logical disconnect from a lot of practitioners that think because we know the science, people will follow it.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah,
some people do.
Yeah,
some people, science is super important, and for a lot of people it's not.
Yeah, smoking is a good example, right? You wouldn't, no one connecting A with B would logically smoke, but we still.
No, but we still.
20% of us still smoke.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We see that. So I worked at Chevron, and it really, it wasn't a fit that I particularly felt comfortable with because I loved the role. I loved working with the company from a perspective of helping its employees and building these health systems. But I'm an entrepreneur at heart, and I like really building things where I've got more freedom.
Right, and that's the basic problem with practicing medicine in a hospital system or even in a bureaucracy of a large company for you, is that there's that spirit of entrepreneurship that's sitting inside there and always has.
It always has. And I reckon when I look backwards, I can connect the dots in a way that I couldn't looking forwards.
Yeah.
And I look back when I was that medical student and that junior doctor that was a bit frustrated and really wanted to build and do things differently. There was no real provision to do that.
Yeah.
And the structure really limits your autonomy until you become a specialist on the outside. But even then, you're relatively geographically linked. You need to be working in your main field. So I was always just so curious and really wanted to get out and do things differently.
Right. But are you glad you did that training when then, or do you see another path that you might have taken? What do you make
in terms of instead of doing medicine?
Yeah.
No, I loved it.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I'm a fully registered medical practitioner in Australia because the Australian Medical Board, they recognise that medical practice is beyond the clinic.
Yeah.
And practice can involve research, policy, management, teaching. So there's many different other areas. And when I look back, It's a question I get quite a fair bit because a lot of people are very used to, you do a medical degree, you become a practicing doctor.
That's the usual way, right?
Absolutely. It's the vast majority. And we need that as well. That should be the majority. But when I look at myself, a friend of mine put it like this. There's many other people, Carlo, they've got really great skills that can do things really well in a clinical world.
Yeah.
You've got something that you can really do something in a different way around leadership and business in health. Yeah.
So post Chevron, you end up back in Silicon Valley.
Well, I did, but there was an interesting journey along that path where I actually came to New Zealand with my best mate from America,
yep.
and we did. It was just after New Year. We landed in Christchurch. We did an overnight there, and we were driving to Queenstown. It's a 9-hour drive. We stopped at some hot springs during the day. We're probably time zones between Perth and New Zealand. We're a little bit off. And as it turns out, we're an hour out of New Zealand and we're driving in the mountains. Out of Queenstown. And we're in the mountains and out of nowhere, I just get hit with fatigue.
Yeah.
It just hits me.
Like eye closing, nodding off fatigue.
The eye nose, the head nod. And I remember I thought, wow, I really need to pull over.
Actual micro sleeping, right?
Yeah, almost micro sleeping. And I thought, I'll pull over just after this bend. And the next time I wake up is my friend yelling out my name as we drive off the side of the road and we roll the car.
Oh, right. So you're actually now conscious while you're going, what are you thinking at this
point? I woke up mid-turn of the car and my friend's yelling out my name. He calls me Doc. He's like, Doc. Roll the car. And it was all in slow motion. And I thought, let's see what happens now. Literally, that was my thought. We were turning. The car was entering a corkscrew in this ditch. And I was like, we'll see what happens now. And everything felt in very much, it was slow. It was a bit dreamy, probably because I just woke up from sleep, friend said.
Were you scared? No.
It didn't feel scary at all. We very fortunately, about 50 meters earlier, we would have driven straight off a cliff.
Oh, my goodness.
I would have driven straight off a cliff.
Yeah.
And out of all the randomness that you need to happen to save yourself or whatever happens, we entered three rolls in this ditch, and the mechanics of it essentially meant that we corkscrewed one way, corkscrewed the other, kept going forward. There were no rocks, no trees in the way. And then
which could have been fatal.
Absolutely. And then the car jumped out of the ditch, landed on all four wheels facing forward.
And you were unharmed.
We were unharmed. And we were in a Toyota Land Cruiser. I wasn't necessarily a huge fan of Toyotas before that, but after that, I was like, this is the best car ever made.
You didn't want to be in a Suzuki Swift or something.
We were supposed to be in a much smaller car, and it was actually my friend that said we might get the biggest four-wheel drive that we can get. And it was one of those moments in life that this was the closest to death that I'd ever reached.
Yeah, right.
And it really makes you think about what's important, where do you want to be.
So what happens at this point? You jump out of the car.
We jump out of the car.
And the adrenaline hits and start shaking and just going, oh, my goodness.
No, actually, I was incredibly calm. But my friend, he describes it as, you were calm because you slept through it. You slept through the horror movie. I had to watch the horror movie because he was awake.
And he had no control, right?
He had no control at all. So what happened? We jumped out of the car. We ran to the front of the car. We pointed at each other, are you okay? Are you okay? We gave each other a massive hug. And then behind us, directly driving behind us was two Asian tourists, would have been about 65, and they got out of the car. They'd seen it all happen driving by. They stopped. They got out of the car like they had seen two ghosts reappear.
Yeah.
And the lady came up to my friend and was just sobbing uncontrollably to the point where my friend needed to give her a hug and comfort her. So then a New Zealand farmer stopped, checked the car out. Well, it should be all right. And then we actually got back in the car. And drove it to New Zealand. And we drove
drivers.
To Queenstown. We did switch drivers. But I was like, I'm awake now.
Yeah, right. Like you got adrenaline going, right?
Yeah.
And then, but this is a moment where you're actually reflecting on things.
Yeah, and I think it really unraveled in some ways after that, where we made it safely to Queenstown and safely since then. This is now 3.5 years ago. And it just really provokes a lot of thought and consideration. And I wouldn't say that it wasn't one of those moments where you have a complete change in your life and you start questioning things differently. It wasn't that. What it was catalyst.
Yeah.
It was reflection that when it is all over and when you do die, you either did it or you didn't do it.
Yeah.
There was no, I was thinking about doing it.
Yeah, right.
You either did it or you didn't.
Yeah.
So after that, I went back to Perth. I was already thinking about my time at...
Hey, I just want one random question.
Yeah, please.
What happens when you take the rental car back? So, here's
so the rental...
We're doing a better now.
my friend tells the funny story, which is totally true. But we had full insurance on the rental car.
Yeah.
And I originally booked a smaller car. He was the one that was said, get a bigger one. I said, my travel insurance has got the rental excess covered. Yeah. He was like, no, get the full insurance. Always get the full insurance.
Yeah.
And when we went out and we actually picked up the car, I was going around, I was like, there's this little scratch here, there's this little scratch there, circling them on that diagram that you have to.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when we took the car back, you have to call the company and say you've had an accident.
Yeah.
And we took the car back, the guy was like, any damage? We're like, there's a few scratches and there's a bit of an accident.
And, rolled it three times.
The pillar of the car, the metal piece next to where your driver connecting to the roof of the car, that had sheared.
Yeah.
That took all the brunt. And it was one of those things. It was like, that is insurance. That is, thank you, insurance.
Yeah.
Thank you, we have it.
Yeah, right.
But it was a bit funny in terms of my focus on all the scratches before.
Yeah, right.
And the way it came back.
Okay, so you're heading back out of the country. Where are you going now?
So I went back to Australia. I finished up with Chevron. I felt that I'd really built something great there and it was time to move on. And I actually went exploring. I booked a one-way ticket to South Korea with a plan, no plan, but the goal was I wanted to go to diverse, ideologically provocative places and places where I felt that it would really provoke creativity.
Yeah.
And it's led me on a really interesting journey. So I started my own consulting business and coaching business where I work with a lot of leaders and executives, mostly in the health field, but not only in the health field, around performance and mindset.
Yeah.
As well as that, I moved back to Silicon Valley for a bit of time, where I joined an artificial intelligence startup.
Yeah.
And what I really wanted to do with that, it was a good friend of mine who's an AI practitioner. I could see the world moving in that space, and I was like, You either get involved and you learn it. Or you're totally out of it. So I wanted to learn enough that I could be useful as a non-techie and connect those dots.
Right, you were never going to be writing code. But you
I was never going to be writing code, no. But I needed to speak the language. Because I think language is so important in whether it's whatever field.
Just like medicine, right?
That's what I mean. Medicine's a language. Healthcare is a language. Wellness is language. And language is so powerful in both transmitting of ideas, but also connection between people.
Yeah.
So I did that. And so that over the last 3.5 years, it's been a really, really wonderful experience of exploration, considering new ideas, perspectives, building my own coaching and consulting practice, doing some interesting work, moving to the US, working with another friend in London around building an interesting product in coaching, and then recently joining Precure.
Yeah. And so tell us a little about that part of the journey, because I get the sense that you're finding yourself more and more working in the health space than in innovation, and we'll talk about what that even means in a moment.
Yep.
But you're working more and more in that. You've been drawn back into health, but in a slightly different way.
Yeah, so even when I was working in the artificial intelligence startup, we were consulting to very large healthcare companies in the US where the leadership of the company is recognizing that healthcare is increasingly becoming a data business in many ways. Obviously, a significant consumer and customer and patient side, but data is becoming more and more important. So when I look back at my career, health has always been the consistent and the center point where I've gone and for periods of time worked and immersed myself in other fields and then brought back that knowledge to health.
Yeah.
And I've always found that very useful and quite enriching, both from a personal perspective, but then also from a value perspective that you can add to the healthcare ecosystem, because health can often be somewhat insular.
Yeah. So just tell me a bit more about Silicon Valley.
Yep.
There's a lot of talk about that and innovation mm-hmm. and the innovation center of the world.
Yep.
Really. What do you make of being there? And then the second part to that, so if we can remember it long enough to get to it, is what is innovation even?
Sure. So in terms of Silicon Valley, it's a fascinating place, firstly. It's it really is, in many ways, it is the leading, or at least one of the leading now, epicenters of technological change and innovation and growth in the world. So I was there in 2011 and again last year, and it's changed a lot during that time as well. Yep. So the characteristics of it, you've got a lot of smart people in a very small geographic space, and people that are pretty hungry to build things
yep.
and to solve problems.
Yep.
There's a lot of money around, yep. particularly there's a lot of cash in venture capital, which yep. is, venture capital is largely a way of investing in early stage companies. They usually take a portfolio approach where yep. they know that the vast majority are going to fail or not work out.
Yep.
We just don't know which ones.
Yeah, right.
And making big bets about the future.
Because a lot of other places still do stuff without that venture capital. Like, that doesn't exist in Australia and New Zealand in the same way it does in
the same way.
Does that prevent you from doing the same work?
I personally think, yes, it does. And it doesn't exist in the same way for a couple reasons. One, we just don't have the same amount of capital. New Zealand, small country, Australia, small country, the United States, much larger country, largest economy in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's an issue of scale, number one. The second part is there's an issue also of experience. So to build a healthcare digital, healthcare technology company, or any type of tech company, you largely need a lot of smarts along the way.
Yeah.
And if I look at, say, where I'm from in Western Australia, most value has been created in the state around mining and resources and real estate.
Yep.
So we've got a lot of smart investors that know those fields well, but they're relatively foreign.
And they've done well out of
them. They've done very well out of it. And I think New Zealand's really relatively similar. So yeah. there's, you can bubble away and get companies off the ground, but if you really want to grow and grow fast,
yeah.
when you're around an environment that is all conspiring towards that end outcome, your odds of succeeding are higher.
Right. So if you're investing as a venture capitalist, you need a high concentration of real smart people, and you need them to be working damn hard.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. So this is very interesting now. I'll segue onto that discussion about what is innovation.
Yeah.
And to me, innovation, it's progress. Yeah. But it's progress through discovering new ideas and better ways of doing things.
Yeah.
And when you look at the countries that have been most innovative in many ways, what you just said is really, really interesting about having a critical talent pool in a small area working really hard.
Yeah.
So the countries you see that happen and who have been innovative leaders globally in tech, South Korea,
yep.
in telecommunications, in shipping, mm-hmm. in cars.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a very small country, very, very tight focus of control, and also had quite a high amount of conflict with their neighbor North Korea.
Yeah.
So there was some form of
focus.
Pain or yeah. focus, right? Israel.
And extraordinarily hardworking.
Oh, absolutely. A very, very hardworking job. Very similar in Israel.
Yeah.
Israel in the Middle East. I just went there a couple months ago leading a healthcare
yeah.
group actually from Western Australia, and it was fascinating to see that in Israel, same thing, 8 million people, incredibly small geographical area. Everyone sort of knows everyone because, yeah. or one degree of separation away because of military service, and a very high amount of conflict around and existential threat
yeah.
in many ways.
Yeah, is that threat, is that useful? I never even thought of that.
Yeah, so is it useful? I guess it depends how you define being useful. But if you define being useful around being innovative,
yeah.
It does seem to have usefulness. And Silicon Valley in the US actually all started, when you track it back to what's the origins, it was the US military investing and in companies and at Stanford University around military products and the like.
Yeah, right.
And then that sort of then built people, brought people together to build companies and the like with the funding around, and then it built a bit of an ecosystem and got people there. So I actually think it's something I think about a lot, particularly from an Australian point of view, and New Zealand may well be similar, but life's really comfortable.
That's right.
In Australia.
And we can just go and take it easy and everything's going to be all right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it leads to a certain amount of complacency.
Yeah.
And innovation is really, really hard to occur from a place of complacency.
Yeah.
I think it really happens from a place of discomfort.
So what we really need in New Zealand is for Australia to turn completely rogue and a military state and just be threatening to invade us the whole time.
I think what we either need like a pretend game of like battleships where everyone thinks that, or probably more there's some form of there'd be an interesting one around what if we flip that around unity and the like.
Yeah.
What do both countries potentially need that we could actually support each other with?
Yeah. Is it part of the Silicon Valley thing also the highly motivated, intelligent migrant population that's moved from places that have been extremely poor, there's been poverty or the quality of life. And that fact, you know, if you think about sort of the whole South Asia, India, Bangladesh region as
so
an example.
That's very interesting. So there is a very high amount of transient workforce. They're not from the area. They've come in.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people are both American and there's a lot of migrants in the area.
But super smart ones.
Super smart ones.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I had a really interesting discussion with an Indian friend of mine because my dad, who's an Italian migrant, moved country to come to Australia and Australia's delivered that better life and the opportunity that he sought. He's like, why would you ever want to leave? It's such a great, amazing place.
Yeah.
Whereas my Indian friend's dad is like, can't wait for him to hop on the plane to America because he's so proud that his son is in America.
Yeah.
Now, absolutely, that's a big part of it. And probably an even better example of the migrant and the mixing of skills is in Israel, there was a significant influx of about 2 million people from the USSR, Russian Jews, after the collapse of the Soviet, or around the collapse of the Soviet Union, where they basically got, Israel got 2 million people coming in, and a lot of them were skilled. But as I was told by a friend of mine, a lot of them were very, very skilled, very smart, but they may have been skilled in older technology as well that they had in Russia.
Yeah.
So that's a great story around migrant talent coming into a country and really supporting its growth.
And then reinventing yourself as you go.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
And I think very much back to the Silicon Valley example, it's that American dream. That's what people go. They go to build something big, become whatever they want to become. And with that is often an idea or connected to wealth creation.
Yeah. And there's a strong ethos around that. And is that always good?
In my opinion, no. In my opinion, no, I don't think it is always good. I really, really enjoyed my time in the United States, there's quite a different ideology. And specifically in healthcare, it's really interesting because in the US, I often found myself in discussions where the debate and the discussion would focus on should people have the right to healthcare?
Yeah, right.
That's where the debate's at.
Yeah, we're miles. It's not even a debate, and most.
It's not a debate. No one's talking about it here. No one is arguing the point that we shouldn't have the right to healthcare.
Yeah.
We're arguing about the ways we think we should deliver healthcare, and that this is, you know, this could be so much better and the like.
Yeah.
But over there in the US, it's a different focus of the debate. And personally, I found that fatiguing because you don't convince people. People hold on to their views very, very tightly, and I feel that energies can be spent in more productive conversations.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about the future for yourself and then and then actually humanity, what's your hope there, and what's the best, if you think about best possible futures, what does that look like for you? Where's all this going? You've done so much.
Mm.
In quite a short time, right? So, for someone who's a bit older, look and just go, oh, that's astonishing.
Yeah.
So, what is going to happen?
So, from a personal perspective, the almost the internal mantra, what I think really drives me, it's curiosity and being really useful.
Yeah.
And when I look at what really led me here, it was a path of curiosity, but it's always been, I really wanted to use these skills that I've developed in a useful way.
Yeah.
And going forward, I know that there is a massive opportunity in the broader world of healthcare around connecting dots in a different way than we have before.
Yeah.
And impacting people's lives, whether that be prevention, whether that be productivity within the system, whether that be mortality and morbidity,
yeah.
There's just so much opportunity to do that. And I've recently relocated back to Australia,
yeah.
where I it's time to return home,
yeah.
And really contribute to that, the more local world,
yeah.
my more local community, Australia, New Zealand, yeah. I'll be working here for periods. So that's what excites me now.
Yeah.
And it's creating something new around that with a group of people that are also passionate about making a difference.
And so what could that world look like?
So,
and you know, like specific terms, what would we be doing differently that would,
okay,
that would be better for humanity? That would,
yeah,
as wealthy countries, we would actually be doing better.
Oh, there's a big question, and there's many different answers. I'll give some specific examples that I would be really eager to see in say Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
So, I'm working with a variety of different government groups in Australia around the question of how do we actually drive innovation,
yeah.
and the like. And with that, I do see and I do observe, because I was one of those people where people leave,
yeah.
and they move away, and the talent builds up somewhere else.
Yeah.
I think it's really important we attract people back,
yeah.
to contribute to the local community. Around innovation, I've got this really, really strong curiosity around really audacious competitions,
yeah.
that you can mobilize communities, a country, around solving audacious social challenges.
Like a sort of X Prize, but...
Exactly. Very much like an X Prize, but on a local level.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, it might be, we want to reduce obesity by 20% in this defined community.
Yeah.
But we don't say how, we don't give you any framework with that, and we let the market sort it out.
Yeah.
I don't see that really exists hardly anywhere in healthcare.
Yeah.
It's very much, we'll tell you what to do.
Yeah, and or we'll put an RFP out with our already decided parameters,
Parameters, or that whole grant process,
yeah.
in awarding money and funds. We got to apply for it with set ideas what we're going to do. Then we're going to find out 9 months later if we're successful to mobile. Like, it's really disconnected.
Yeah.
And the world of startups that I worked in is super dynamic and agile,
yeah.
where we're going to interact with the world today,
yeah.
and we're going to get information back today, and then we're going to see what we change. So I think there's a really big opportunity. What I would love to see from a personal perspective in our home areas,
yeah.
it's the leadership thinking and connecting to that progression,
yeah.
the technological change, because we countries like Australia that are highly reliant on resource and the like, where the tech capability often gets offshored,
yeah.
are at risk, and there's so much opportunity there to mobilize and bring people back. It's a complex issue. It can't be solved overnight.
Yeah.
But it really, I think, stems from like bold leadership and visionary leadership, like we've seen with some other countries,
yeah.
and rallying around focus of what's really, really important in our society.
Right. And then the opposite side to that, of course, is if you're trying to do that, then sometimes you're going to get wrong and you'll spend a lot of money on stuff that didn't work out. How does society tolerate that?
I'm having this interesting discussion with... different members of governments at the moment where people vote for them,
yeah.
and they're facing that exact problem.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting. So there's this interesting example of a government project that I know of, and it was experimentation in wave energy.
Yeah.
So technology, we can extract energy from waves, highly experimental, government funded, and it failed. And they got crucified in the media for funding a failing project.
Right.
And that type of discourse, I think, is really unproductive. There's a difference between you need checks and balances and we're not going to burn all of our money up the wall, but there's smart ways of doing it.
Yeah.
And if we societally condemn people for trying different things,
then we'll never make any progress.
We will never make any progress. And that is one thing that you absolutely don't see in the Silicon Valleys, in Israel, in certain elements of South Korea, probably different parts where failure is viewed a bit differently. But there is a real hunger and an acknowledgement that we're going to fail, but we're also going to move ahead and move that needle ahead. And every failure gives us a learning and a teaching that we didn't have before.
Right, because just to pick on a Western Australian example of, yeah, of medical innovation, which in the context of rest of society looks incredibly lame,
yeah,
is the Helicobacter bacterial
pylori
in ulceration. What's the guy's name in Western Australia? I can't remember.
Barry Marshall.
Yeah. And so he's just got a new hypothesis about stomach ulceration. He shows it experimentally, but people don't believe him. And he has to take himself, and he wins the Nobel Prize in medicine, like the highest prize for innovation. Yeah, in a Silicon Valley context, you look at it, it's just laughable, isn't it?
So the thing about that's really interesting, and Nobel Prizes are largely awarded decades after the actual research and the scientific or the achievement for most of the prizes. So the thing about Barry Marshall, and I obviously wasn't around when he was going through these periods of this thought that that stomach ulcers are caused by bacteria, not by stress and like that was thought then. But he must have been thought like, he's a crazy, crazy dude. Yeah. Everyone would have been like, this guy is nuts.
Yeah.
He's genuinely nuts.
Yeah.
And then when you show the science and you prove your hypothesis, you're a genius.
Yeah.
And we see that historically in so many different fields where it's crazy up until the day it's a genius idea.
Yeah. But then why does it get labelled in these extremes? Because it's actually was never that crazy. And, you know, it was a good scientific breakthrough, but it's not that genius.
I think there's a few interesting reasons around that. I think that people have a comfort of the past because it's familiar.
Yeah.
And
even if it's wrong.
Even if it's wrong.
And doing harm.
Absolutely. Yeah. That doesn't matter. There is, generally speaking, a level of comfort around the past and a level of uncertainty around the future.
Yeah.
And if your hypothesis somehow infringes on my beliefs or my position or my authority, it only increases the uncertainty that I have about the future.
Right.
And then it's very easy to just try and suppress and kill new ideas because it just reinforces and supports the incumbent. We briefly spoke of last night in science, some of the greatest achievements, when you map them out, where there's been significant movement in a field, happens after the incumbent holder of that view
dies. Yeah.
Right. Like, why does that happen?
Yeah. Well, that's dissonance. Let's talk about dissonance, because we're also talking about dissonance. You know, you'll move your belief to match your current behaviour and knowledge.
Yep.
But we've been working with some significant changes in the way you think about how food affects your health.
Yeah,
over the last couple of weeks.
Yep.
And you keep coming back and going, I'm finding this really hard. Not from a behavioural point of view, but from a
cognitive dissonance point of view. Yeah. So what Grant's referring to there, I shared that I work as a coach. I work as a coach around leadership and mindset, and I'm going to be leading Precure's coaching for all of the healthcare coaches coming forward. And I'm a doctor as well. I've been trained in all this.
Yeah.
And health for me, it's been a real yo-yo and a bit of a roller coaster from a personal perspective. So I've gone through periods of fatness and fitness, more fatness in recent years chubbiness.
Yeah.
And I've had high blood pressure for a while and dyslipidemia.
Yeah.
And I've recently started on a keto diet, working with Grant and the Precure team as an experiment to try that, because I haven't done full keto before.
As an aside, we discuss this. It's like you've got all this medical stuff, and then age 36, you're medicated for hypertension.
Yeah, absolutely. And the part that I find interesting is I've personally, so when I got diagnosed with hypertension, I was actually about 26.
Yeah.
And my dad also had hypertension from his mid 20s.
Yeah.
So, and you ask, is there a genetic link? and then investigate other causes. Yeah. And I've got a medical degree, and I've worked in primary care, I've worked in cardiology, I've worked in emergency, and no one along that journey has suggested to me that a link between hyperinsulinemia and hypertension. No, it has not been mentioned.
Yep.
And I've always been curious, and I've always been
even
at a loss.
Even though that's the primary cause.
Well, it's not the primary cause in textbooks. Its primary cause is unknown.
Yeah.
So the thing that has been so interesting for me, but also super frustrating, by the way,
yeah,
is like I'm like, there's got to be a reason that describes this. And I get always told, you just got to improve your lifestyle. And I was like, my lifestyle is pretty good overall.
Yeah.
Pretty young. I'm still reasonably active. So there's periods where I'm super active.
Yeah.
There's periods where I'm less active, like most people. Yeah. And then I'm like, there's been periods where I've been also super fit. And I've always struggled with the maintenance of that.
Yeah.
You bounce back. So there's that. And then the same with the dyslipidemia. I just, reading through all different things, I found it so difficult to understand really where is the cutting edge science at about LDL, HDL,
triglycerides.
It seemed too simple a hypothesis that LDL's bad, HDL's good.
Yeah.
And that's what people look at. That's what the coronary risk ratios are based on. So it was always just like, it was just puzzling and frustrating.
Yeah.
So it's been interesting. Grant and I have been talking about hypertension, what underpins that from a perspective and a belief around hyperinsulinemia, and then cholesterol synthesis and cardiac risk.
Yeah.
And I'm experimenting with the keto. And as Grant said, there's this cognitive dissonance because things that I'm eating, the high fat diet, the carbohydrate restricted, as I'm eating it, there's a feeling like this can't be good for me.
Yeah, right. It's going in your mouth and you're just going, oh.
It's everything I've been taught the opposite. Yeah. I've been trained for years and years that it shouldn't be like this.
Yeah.
And that's actually really hard to like process it in my head.
Yeah.
And it's still a challenge.
Yeah.
And I imagine it's going to be one for quite a while.
Mm. And how have you been feeling?
So this is now my eighth day on keto. Overall, I've been feeling great.
Yeah.
I've been feeling really, really well. So
I expected worse symptoms from you, frankly. I thought you're going to be a carb addict who was off the wagon and was like, whoa, someone's
strapping down. I'm not a carb addict, but I do enjoy a healthy bowl of pasta. It's usually a pretty big bowl as well.
Yeah, from my family.
That's right. So the part was, it was actually really quite easy to introduce.
Yeah.
There was one day where I was feeling a bit lightheaded around lunch, but I hadn't eaten anything for breakfast. I had actually had eaten lunch, but it was really high protein and low fat.
Yeah.
And that combination of things probably contributed to that.
Yeah.
But that also probably could have happened not on keto as well.
Yeah.
Other than that, I've been feeling good. I'm definitely a bit of weight down.
Yeah, your shirts are looser.
Are looser.
Astonishing.
Yeah, the shirts are looser. And I feel overall really good. And the last couple nights, like day 6 and 7, the sleep quality has been excellent.
Oh, that's interesting. And good. So we'll keep people updated on that journey. And
absolutely.
As it goes.
Yep.
Yeah. So I just wanted to talk, generally with the podcast guests, I ask these five similar questions. We covered some of those, so we'll move through them quickly. But question one, what's good about the healthcare system? And I guess we're talking about as it exists across the developed world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because we say the developed world, but it's actually very different within the developed world.
Yeah.
So, for example, comparing the United States versus Australia, New Zealand, and, say, Scandinavia, all developed world, all very different.
Mm-hmm.
So as a broad generalization, what is good is that the quality of healthcare is overall, from a statistics level, I think pretty good, that people can access care.
Yeah.
They can get care in generally a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
Although very interesting, I don't know if you saw last night or overnight, but on Twitter, an NHS patient, a father that just had a seven-day-old daughter.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson, the new Prime Minister of the UK, went to visit the hospital and he absolutely challenged Boris to his face, saying that NHS is failing. And like, and you hear that a lot from our UK friends.
Yeah.
But within that, I think overall there is a high level of care. Statistically, I think what is good, we're getting more curious as a healthcare system about ways that we can improve.
Yeah.
And those processes are getting more systematized.
Yeah.
And there's an increasing reliance on data.
Yeah.
The data is showing us the truth and will reveal new ways and better ways and problem areas that we need to address.
Yeah. And like you say that car accident had gone worse.
Yep.
And you've been wheeled in with an acute injury.
Yeah.
It's likely we would have, you're no bit of time in human history to have your chances of doing well out of that.
So on aggregate, 100%.
Yeah.
Like on aggregate, the technology where we're at now, we are better than we've ever done before.
Yeah.
In terms of the personal experience though, and this is what I think is really interesting in health, we look at things from a population level. So at a population level, we're going great.
Yeah.
But on the micro basis, it really depends on what system did you specifically connect with? Which hospital, which practitioner, what was the experience?
And how long had they even been on duty?
Things like that.
Yeah.
There's a variability of micro outcome. Yeah. And this is the disconnect in many ways between what's good for the population health and our data says, but what's best for Grant or what's best for Carlo might actually be different.
Yeah.
And we're moving in that direction of personalized and precision medicine. We're certainly not there yet.
Yeah. So what doesn't work?
My biggest frustration in the healthcare sector largely is around leadership.
Yeah.
I think that there is a massive opportunity for leaders within health to really open their minds about how can we can do things differently. And that's a very difficult, it's easy to say in a sentence, it's very difficult to do practically, particularly when the leaders of health have often come up through the system and been rewarded for their tenure and experience and achieving things at different times. So we have a point now where a lot of leaders are in that group of say 50 to 65, thereabouts, but the world has changed. The opportunities with technology have changed. The use of data has changed. And not only that, it's going to change so much more in the next 10 years plus.
Because of exponential change.
Exponential change, the use of data, but also artificial intelligence is something we haven't seen in human history. In my opinion, it would be the most powerful technological provoker of change and technological advances. And it comes with its own perils as well. And in health, we're going to see things that we have previously prioritized humans as the decision makers, where machines will be able to make much better decisions with much more data in much shorter time.
Radiology is a good example, right?
Radiology, absolutely, because it's pixels on a screen and the interpretation. And there's some companies that are doing some really interesting work there.
Yeah.
Dermatology is enough. Pathology, all the visual type specialties, but also in other areas as well, where it's really complex decision making. And our healthcare practitioners may have a small sample set of patients that we really need to make decisions on. And now in larger databases, they'll be able to do that a lot more.
Yeah.
So with that, that's number one.
But hang on. If you took 100 leaders in that demographic just described to us, senior leaders in health, I reckon 99 of them would say, we need to do things differently.
Yeah.
So they would utter the exact same first sentence that you said.
Yeah.
Nothing will change.
Yeah, and that is a common complaint. And what I have seen that's quite interesting is, in my personal experience, I have observed differences in the private sector of leaders and CEOs that say we have to do things differently, and government, where we have to do things differently. There seems to be a lot more inertia within government and bureaucracy and the like.
Yeah.
And in private organizations with a dynamic leader that says we need to do things differently, in many ways it's interesting because it's who you hire and fire in organizations sets the tone of the culture, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, I have heard a lot of leaders say we need to do things differently, and yet their behaviors reinforce the status quo.
Yeah.
And that's just lip service versus walking the talk.
Right. But there's a risk adversity in a...
There is a risk adversity. And with that, there's two ways, I think, to drive change. Yeah. One is massive vision and massive purpose and rallying people towards a better world.
Yeah.
The other way is massive discomfort and massive pain. And on an individual organizational level, you've got to figure out which one really it is and what's the lever to try and pull.
So back to your own health, I'm going to discuss this, but what do you do? What's your strategy?
So I would answer that. It depends on when you've asked me. what would the strategy be? I've done a variant of low carb before. I've done periods where I've really, really high intensity exercise training for triathlons and the like.
Yeah.
And I've had periods where I've really done nothing and just sort of like cruised along.
Yeah.
Now, the things that I've always found have worked for me in the past, from an activity perspective, I've loved yoga, loved dancing, cycling, and generally where I've made large progress is around I've done something with other people towards a common goal, competing in a team triathlon or something around that.
Yeah.
So there's that. Diet-wise for me has been, I think, the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
And now... trialing the keto diet, and for the next 21 days total, it'll be, I think, a really, really interesting introduction. And then the issue for me will be that, like, continuity and going.
Yeah.
The thing that I find, I do believe mindset is, in many ways, your most important thing in life.
Yeah.
And the mindset that's worked for me in the past was really quite powerful, because I was beating up a bit on myself. Why am I chubby? Why is this all happening? Yeah. And I just made this decision. I was like, you know what? I am healthy Carlo.
Yeah.
And rather than act like unfit Carlo to become healthy Carlo, I am healthy. So I just made decisions as if I was already fully as healthy as I am.
That's an interesting idea, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's something that already in the last week, I think when I first started the keto a week ago with you, I was a bit like, I've got to do something. Like within 2-3 days, I could connect to that I am healthy Carlo.
Yeah.
And it's been powerful, and I feel powerful now to continue that on.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. So what do you do badly around your health and you don't see an easy solution to?
The biggest thing that I do badly, so I travel a lot.
Yeah.
I travel a lot for work.
Yeah.
And that means I'm often away for periods of time, and then I move back home. I go see people in Perth.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, when we catch up, it's social.
Right.
So there's big dinners, there's nice wine, those type of things.
Yeah.
And I often find that very destabilizing.
Yeah.
Because you might have three in a row,
yeah.
3 days, and then that becomes like I'm off kilter.
Yeah.
So the biggest challenge...
And you've got jet lag chucked on top of that.
All those things.
Yeah.
And then you bounce off, and then the people you go see in your next place, they're happy to catch up as well and do the same. Right. So the one thing that is always destabilizing for me is it's around social activity and really getting off track.
Yeah.
So the part that I want to do differently with that is being based in Perth with more routine, and there'll still be the travel, but there'll be a bit less.
Yeah.
I think it'll give me a bit more ownership of it. The other part is connect with people more socially around activity-based things.
Right, right.
Doesn't have to be a dinner. Doesn't have to be a let's go out.
Because generations which are younger than me and even you are doing more and more of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea of going to the pub and just drinking is not a thing in younger people.
Well, I've read that, and I think it's probably interesting. I'd be really curious for like who doesn't attach to drinking and who does.
Yeah.
Because I think the richness of the data will be in that.
Yeah. Customer interviews.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, but for me, I know there's a few protective mechanisms that I can put around it. Yeah. The other part is I used to have a personal trainer who works and the gym's 100 meters from my house.
Yeah.
And that convenience of just popping out of my house and having a commitment and an accountability to go was really powerful. So I'm going to start that immediately as soon as I go home.
Yeah.
So hopefully that routine, the ongoing commitment, and changing the way about those social connections that becomes more protective will support the journey towards greater health.
Yeah. So as a doctor and an innovator, what and someone who's interested in health, what do you say to other people about their health?
Yeah.
And where do you think your credibility starts and stops?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question around the credibility piece. Yeah. So in my mind, credibility is linked to results. And it's interesting in healthcare with the question around placebo, because we go like, how powerful is the placebo effect? And there's a fair bit of evidence that supports it.
Quite powerful.
It's very powerful, right? So then you go, is it credible that if you do something that's a placebo effect or the like, that, you know, you've got credibility there? And I'm like, actually, to me, it's based on the outcome.
Yeah.
And when I work with other people around their health, particularly with executives is who I work with,
yeah,
I really seek to find what their drivers are, what their motivators are. Because what hasn't worked for me, because I know the knowledge, and also I think a lot of people, the sleep more, drink less. I've never been a big drinker, hasn't been my thing. Yeah. My thing's been probably around portion size with food. But that's just like, yeah, I know it, it's boring. But when you really can connect with someone, you go, what's important in your life?
Yeah.
And everyone's got a different answer.
They've got hope about something.
Yeah, so someone it might be, what's really important is job security. Or another one might be, it's being the best husband or father I can be.
Yeah.
Or the best mum. Or what's really important is developing my confidence because I feel broken at the moment. And if you can really connect with that deep driver and that deep need within someone, and then make the connection towards what can you do in your life that's going to help you achieve that, that also promotes and connects your health.
Yeah.
The ideal is to enter a reinforcing series of behaviors that people then want to continue on their own. And they're going to get off the path. They're going to fall off. But it's really around, I seek to understand what people really, really are seeking.
And those examples you mentioned are utterly different things, right?
Absolutely.
So people are hoping and aspiring for completely different, best possible futures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always found it really curious because I've worked a reasonable amount in executive leadership and health. And you talk with a quarter of the people would just look after themselves anyway, health-wise.
Yeah.
They're actually really pretty committed.
Yeah.
A quarter would be the other end of the spectrum. Yeah. They're just like, I just don't want to
do it. Yeah, it's actually hard to work with that.
100%. Yeah. And the 50% in the middle are sort of like ticking along, could improve things. It's not terrible, but it's like, if you talk to them about, I think you should sleep more, they're like, do you know how many emails I get? Do you know my phone rings so much?
Yeah.
Like, I think you should, like, you know, drink less. Like, I've got social functions to go to, but if you're like, what really drives you?
Yeah.
People are like, I really, really want to either succeed in this role, or like I said, a personal goal about, you know, I'm really an absent parent because at the moment I'm so busy and committed. And then you can start having a really interesting dialogue and diving deep.
Yeah.
And to me, that's where if you can get someone in a state of resonance around where they can see a better future and it connects with their need, that's where you can get a node of change.
And I guess that's where we've been both with Precure seeing an opportunity where we can contribute to society with that role of a health coach.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. I think there's a few really interesting things with that. So one is from a pure personal perspective. My family, a lot of my members, my dad's one of nine, and many of them have chronic health issues.
Yeah.
Diabetes, cancer, coronary artery disease, hypertension. I'm living it and I'm looking at my personal future and I'm like, that's not what I want for my personal future. And I need to change my behaviors for that. Number two, in a broader sense of my experience in healthcare, and this is largely discussed, you know, we talk about sick care, we don't talk about healthcare.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really interesting around our healthcare system. And another part of the question about what would you change is the financial remuneration that we have for healthcare practitioners within the system is largely linked to service-based and not really linked to preventative areas. If we prevent you getting something, no one really gets financially rewarded.
No, in fact, you get punished in many ways if you're trying to earn a living in medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. And and incentives drive behavior.
Yeah.
You need to get the incentives right for the system to work in the way. And then broader speaking around, why wouldn't you just want to live like as best an active life and healthy and functional as you can?
Well, you ask anyone just broadly about their life and their aspirations and being healthy enough to achieve those things, almost always comes into it almost immediately.
Yep.
Yeah.
100%.
Carlo Bellini, thank you.
Thanks so much, Grant. It's been a real pleasure.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to the Flippin' Health Podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Precure. Prevention is cure. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe. If you know someone who could benefit, please share it with them. Together, we can change medicine for the better. Change medicine for good.